Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. Today, we are going to undertake an exposition of the Old Testament book of Esther. Let me, first of all, introduce it, tell you briefly the story of Esther, and then we will move on from there. The book of Esther was written during the 58-year gap that occurs between the 6th and 7th chapter of Ezra. The span of time in the book is about 10 years. The events going on were around the time of 483 B.C. and 473 B.C. Some people say, and they're right up to a point, that the purpose of the book of Esther was to account for the Jewish Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M. I-M in Hebrew indicates a plural. Pur means lots. And it takes its name, the Feast of Purim takes its name from the enemy of the Jews, Haman, casting lots to decide upon a day in which to commit genocide against the Jewish people throughout all the provinces of Persia. I think that misses the point a bit. Certainly the book does that. But behind the Feast of Purim is the hand of God, though God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. More about that later. The point of the book, in my view, is to show the providential hand of God in saving his people from annihilation during the time of the king Xerxes, known to us as Ahasuerus, in this book. Let me talk for a moment about what we mean by the providence of God. And perhaps I will meld a bit the idea of the providence of God and what theologians call concurrence. The providence of God is a theological term that we use to describe the direction, the sovereign direction God gives to everything. His providence is not seen in any demonstrable miracle or deed, but rather his providence is seen in the natural flow of events that lead to God's desired effect. In other words, there are events and there are circumstances and there are human agents through whom God, in a secondary way, accomplishes his purposes. For example, we're sick. We go see our doctor. Our doctor may send us to the hospital, and at the end of the day, apparently by medical agents and by medical instruments, procedures, medications, and whatever, we are healed. But we as believers know that these means are secondary. The real healer is God. God does not normally work on the basis of miracles. God is a God of miracles. God has performed miracles. God still performs miracles, but miracles by their very nature are rare. That is not the way God normally does his work. And those brands of theology, however well-meaning, however desirous those dear folk are of wanting to exalt God as still a God of miracles, is misleading, and it's also possibly disillusioning in implying that God's favored means of doing his work in this world is by means of miracle. That is not so. Normally, God does his work, his providing work, his healing work. God does his judging work and all sorts of works through human instruments or through circumstantial situations, or both. And the book of Esther is a classic example of God working providentially. Now we come to the fact that the name of God is not even used in the book of Esther. And folks, that is intentional, because the providence of God is the hidden hand of God. And therefore, in the architecture of this book, God is left out, although there are points, and I will show them, where God is obviously, very obviously, in the background. So we will be doing more than just telling the story of Esther. It's an interesting story. It's an engaging story. It's a compelling story. One of the best narratives anybody could ever read. But it is also a God story. And God is the main actor, even though God is not mentioned. And we see God acting to save his people in a very, very tight situation. And in that way, the book of Esther is kind of a model. It is a pattern. It is a type of God's salvation of his people from the world, and especially of the end-time salvation of the Jewish people from their generations and generations of worldly enemies. Let me, for those who may be less familiar, though I realize everybody doesn't listen every day, so for some this will be a bit wasted, but we always have to contend with that if we're a Bible teacher. Let me tell you, first of all, the story of Esther. Let me just summarize the narrative, the 10 chapters of narrative, and then we will go back and retell the story in a more expanded way and draw the lessons from the story that we intend to. We're never about just retelling biblical narratives. We always want to find in these narratives the relevant lessons for us in our day and our time. Well, the story begins in Xerxes' palace at Susa, 483 B.C., as we mentioned. It's going to cover, I repeat, a period of about 10 years. The king of Persia, that's Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called in this text, provides a lavish banquet and display of his royal glory for the people of Susa in his kingdom. That was the winter palace. Proudly, the king seeks to make Queen Vashti's beauty a part of the program. This whole party went on for about a half year, culminating in this banquet. Well, Vashti refuses to appear. We'll get into the reasons later. The king is counseled by his advisors to dismiss her, and later on, he is counseled by his advisors to seek another queen. It is because they feared that other women throughout the realm would become disobedient if Queen Vashti, so insubordinate to her husband and the king, went unpunished. There was in the realm a girl by the name of Esther. Actually, she had another name, Hadassah, but here she is known as Esther. She was a young, beautiful cousin of Mordecai. And because she had no mother or father but was an orphan, it was Mordecai who undertook to raise her. As the king scours the realm through his agents to find a posse of the most beautiful girls in the realm who might have queenly potential, he comes upon Esther, and she is brought in to the king's harem. She finds favor in the eyes of the king's servant, Hegai, H-E-G-A-I. Hegai was in charge of Xerxes' harem. He then sets about to help Esther win the game, to win the favor of Xerxes, and eventually be selected as the next queen. At Mordecai's instruction, Esther does not reveal the fact that she is Jewish. After Esther becomes queen, Mordecai, who has been her caretaker, is able to get a message inside and warn the king of an impending assassination plot. Investigation was made, it was confirmed to be true, and his deed is recorded in the palace records, though for a long time unremembered by the king. Meanwhile, a man named Haman becomes the captain of the princes. But Mordecai, because Haman's roots are Amalekite, a race of people upon whom rested a divine curse and ban, Mordecai refuses to bow to Haman. When Haman learns that Mordecai is Jewish, the incensed man plots for a year to eliminate all Jews. As his rage and hatred grow and intensified every time he sees Mordecai around the palace gate not bowing to him. So he casts lots, Purim, daily during this period until he determines by astrological signs the best day to have the Jewish people massacred. Through bribery and lies, Haman convinces the king to issue an edict that all Jews in the empire will be slain, given over to genocide in a single day in 11 months. The decree creates a state of grief and confusion as the edict is published throughout the realm of the king of Persia. When Mordecai hears of the plot, he goes into classic Jewish mourning mode. He tears his clothes, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he goes into the city of Susa, wailing loudly and bitterly. Eventually, he convinces Queen Esther to appeal to the king on behalf of the Jews, telling her that this might be why she came to power, and also informing her that if she doesn't act, then the Jews will be restored another way, but she will perish. And by the way, I will mention this later, God is not mentioned in what he said to Esther, but God is mentioned, I think you can see, in a covert way. At the peril of her life, Esther, upon that word, decides to try to see the king and reveal her nationality in a desperate attempt to dissuade Xerxes from following through on the plot of Haman. There was a problem there, however. That'll come up later. After a time of fasting, both on Esther's part and the Jews' part, Esther makes her appearance before the king and is mercifully received, and she wisely invites him to a banquet along with this wicked Haman, a descendant of the Amalekite king Agag. At the banquet, she requests that they attend a second banquet, as she herself seeks the right moment to divulge her request. Haman is flattered and brags to his wife and friends of his high position, but he's still annoyed to the bone and tells his close associates and family that with all of his elevation and with all the honor that is being given to him, being able to be the only one invited to go with the king to the banquet that his wife has prepared, he still cannot rest until this Mordecai fella is dead, because he continues to disrespect him but not bowing to him. So at the council of his wife, Haman, the Amalekite, decides to build a large gallows some 75 feet high to hang Mordecai on. The very next day, he just cannot bear to wait a full year to get rid of this one man. Well, that very night that he and his family and friends were deciding upon this way to dispatch Mordecai, the king, Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, is having trouble getting to sleep. Not an uncommon problem for most any human being, especially those with a lot of responsibility. And so, for some reason, he decides to have his chronicles of his kingship read to him. Must have been near the early morning. Reading about Mordecai's deed that saved his life, that is, his informing the palace of an assassination plot, he realizes, when they came across that particular passage in his chronicles, that nothing had ever been done to honor Mordecai, and so he now determines to do this. The next day, the next morning, Haman comes early to the palace because he's all amped up to get permission to put Mordecai to death and make him feel better. Before Haman can come in from the outer court and state his business, The king beats him to the punch and asks Haman what should be done for a man whom the king himself wishes to honor. Well, in his vanity, Haman assumes the king wants to honor him. So he lays it on thick. He suggests that they put a royal robe on that man that the king would want to honor and put him on a royal horse and have one of the king's noble princes lead this man through the streets and proclaim to everyone loudly that this is what is done for the man whom the king delights to honor. Well, the king thinks it's a great idea, agrees, and tells Haman to go do this very thing for Mordecai. Do it. I like it. Well, Haman, as you can imagine, is humiliated and outraged at being forced to honor the man that he loathes, but he can't say a word. And so he has to go through with it. Well, that night at Esther's second banquet, she finally reveals her wish for her people not to perish. And right there in front of the king, she accuses Haman as the man behind the pernicious plot to massacre the Jewish people in the realm. Well, when all this unfolds, the king is so infuriated he walks out of the room. Haman, frightened out of his skull, approaches Esther, who's lying on a couch, to beg for his life. He gets down in her face, as it were, and virtually sprawls upon her in his panic. Just then, ooh, this is bad, Xerxes walked back into the room and accuses Haman of trying to molest the queen. Just then, one of his attendants, the king's, somehow he was knowledgeable about all this, informed the king of the gallows that Haman had built for Mordecai, and the king there ordered Haman himself to be hanged on those gallows. Actually, he was probably impaled. That was a familiar custom among the Persians, not necessarily in every instance, but that could very well have been what Haman had planned for Mordecai. Now the king has it planned for Haman, since he knows the apparatus is already in place, and just had his servants go out and impale, I suspect, Haman upon that 75 feet high in front of God and everybody. Esther then requested that the king cancel that awful edict against her people. However, I mentioned earlier a problem. There was a peculiarity in Persian law that did not allow a law to be reversed that had been sealed with the signet of the king's ring. So Xerxes' hands were tied by law. However, there was another way. He allows Mordecai to write a counter decree that said, if anyone attacked the Jews on the day of the planned genocide, then the Jews would be free to defend themselves. Well, this royal decree turned the tables. And once people know that that comes from the king himself, who's going to want to be so bold as to stand up against the second edict, especially when they know Esther is a Jew, which was not known before? That changed everything. Furthermore, Mordecai is elevated over the house of Haman. So now the Jews are in a very powerful position in Persia where they were not before. In fact, Mordecai becomes the second in charge, replacing Haman. He's right at the top of the power chain in the Persian kingdom, behind only King Xerxes or Ahasuerus. The outcome of all of this was that to celebrate their deliverance, the Jews instituted and still hold a holiday, which they call the Feast of Purim, or the Feast of Lots. And it is still, as we say, celebrated to this day. But Purim is only the face of the providence of God. It celebrates their deliverance, but that deliverance was from the hand of God, the providential hand of God. Now, what I want you to see is that hidden hand of God all through this story. Because, my friends, that hand of God, which was working for the Jews and for Mordecai and for Esther way back in those days, way back in the 400s, 483 B.C. to 473 B.C., that hand is still working. That redemptive hand is still operating in behalf of God's people. It is working with you and for you who are believers in the Lord Jesus Christ every day and every hour, and most of the time we're not even conscious of it. But it's one of the most beautiful things in the whole life of faith. And we want to talk about it, we want to see it, and remember, as we see it operating here, that this is operative and functional in our lives to this day. So we'll be looking for monuments of God's providence throughout this story. You know, it is a lot easier to cope with unpleasant events and unexpected realities if one knows that what goes wrong is not just my dumb bad luck, but it's part of God's plan. It's also good to know when good things, encouraging things, joyful things come to pass, that we're not just lucky, as the world would put it, but we're beneficiaries of God's providential working. We're pretty well conditioned, we believers are, to see the activity of God in what one might call seismic events, you know, the earthquake events. But folks, we should never forget that God works in and through the small and most ordinary happenings. And sometimes these things have great consequences that we would never imagine, given their seeming routineness, their seeming smallness. God uses little things to accomplish big things. And sometimes they are chains of things, and that's what we're going to see in this story. Just kind of chain reactions where one act of God's providence, one operation of God's providence builds upon another, and then another, and then another, and then we see these great outcomes. And we also see how the providence of God in this story counters the pernicious operations of the enemy. For the enemy, who hates God, hates his people. In this story, the people were the Jewish people, and the enemy, the devil, Satan, still hates the Jewish people and wants to destroy them. But with believing Jews are also those of us who are Gentiles, who are believers, and they've been brought into the fold. And the same devil who hates God's people, and will, in pernicious ways, as I suggested, work through this event, and work through that group, and work through this person, or all of the above, to damage us, to destroy us. But God has a plan for us, and His plan is that at the end of the day, we will be glorified, and we will be exalted. The humble will be elevated, and the proud will be crushed. That is God's plan, and we will see a model, a template, a type of that in operation in the book of Esther. And that is why every time I read it, I'm just elevated. I just feel good. I see the bigger picture in all of the little things. And I hope that you will do the same. And at the end of this story, you'll have a fresh appreciation of the providence of God. And you'll not be all hung up on God always working some seismic miracle, as great as that is, but you'll just appreciate the little things, which are not miraculous, but secondary means and secondary men that God uses to accomplish His purposes. Thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.